today on the 21st. As a child, Wangell Harvey Robinson had both parents behind bars.
Just imagine if every time you talked to your family or you told them you loved them, it was $4.08. Over time, that got too expensive, so you had to stop telling them you loved them. And no child should feel like their love for their family is too expensive.
We'll speak with her and State Representative Carol Ammons about what they're trying to do to change that. Also, what do the FDA's new guidelines on e-cigarettes mean here? We'll speak with the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health, who's also here to take your questions about vaping. You can start tweeting your questions now to us if you want. Our handle is 21st Show. And how many Illinois Republicans are distancing themselves from apparent presidential nominee Donald Trump? We'll talk about that in our Monday Politics segment. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When Wangell Harvey Robinson was in the third grade, both of her parents were in prison. Phone calls were a lifeline for her to connect with them, to talk about her day, to tell them she was doing okay, to tell them that she loved them. But prison phone calls in Illinois can be exponentially more expensive than even international phone calls. Wangell Harvey Robinson lives in the Champaign-Urbana area and joins us in studio. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So it was more than a decade ago that your parents went to prison. You were in third grade. And how long was the period where you were apart from both of your parents when they were incarcerated?
For my mom, it was up until like seventh grade. But for my dad, it was probably my freshman or sophomore year of high school.
So for a good 5-6 year period.
Yes, a long time.
How important were those phone calls for you?
Very important. One, because my dad called maybe once a month, and my mom, she tried calling maybe once a week, but most times we didn't answer it because either it was too expensive or she was just like, I won't call because I know that it can get very costly for you guys.
And when you say very costly, how much money are we talking about? Because I think people who've never heard of this issue might be surprised to know how much phone calls can cost.
Since I was so young, it was mainly my grandmother taking care of the finances regarding the phones, but I know that it was about like maybe $30 just for like a 2-minute phone call that had horrible reception.
And I know you, this is an issue that's really important to you now, and you're working to change that. Why is it so important for you?
Most times when I do things, it's not for myself. So to encourage other younger people who might be dealing with what I'm dealing with to keep going and that it'll get better, it's moving for me because I know that I could get through it so they can get through it too.
That's Wangell Harvey Robinson. She's in studio with me along with State Representative Carol Ammons, who joins us as well. She's the sponsor of a bill that passed the House last week that would cap prison phone rates. She's a Democrat from Urbana. Representative Ammons, thanks for being with us as well.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
How common is that experience that we just heard about with Wangell?
It's a very common experience. We actually began to work on this issue back in about 2004 here in Champaign County. A mother in the community, an activist in the community, Sandra Otten, informed my husband and I, who had no idea about prison phone calls or county jail phone calls, about the cost of the calls and that people were literally having their phones disconnected because of receiving collect calls or trying to make prepaid calls from either a county jail or, in our case, the Department of Corrections. And so we fought that commission back in 2004. And then from that point, it was always on my radar on a national level as well. And we can talk about the FCC ruling.
Mm-hmm. Just to be clear, and just so people can understand, can prisoners receive phone calls?
So they cannot receive phone calls to the institution, but they're calling out of the institutions. And they're either calling by some means of prepaid call cards that their families are purchasing. All of these are expenses are being borne by the family, not the inmate. And so either they're calling collect from the institution to a family member, which is a lot of fees. People will be amazed at how much a penny phone call that we would normally make grows into what Wangell described. That could be a $30 phone call.
That's State Representative Carol Ammons. Last week, the bill she sponsored to limit prison phone rates passed the House and goes to the Senate this week. What does your bill do?
Our bill literally caps that rate at 5 cents a minute, which is a recommended rate from the Illinois Commerce Commission, as well as supported from the Federal Commerce Commission. It also deals with ancillary fees, international calls. We wanted to make sure that the companies who are unregulated largely are able to still make a profit by providing the service, but at the same time regulate their ability to change the prices and add additional fees on top of the rate. So we wanted to deal with that specifically in this legislation. And I think this legislation is probably the strongest in the country at this point.
Let's talk about those fees. Last October, just before the FCC voted to limit the rate on prison phone calls, NPR spoke with Brian Oliver. That's the CEO of Global Telink. That company is the largest in the country in terms of prison calls. And at the time, this was last October, he said the FCC rules would cut his revenue in half. But he said the real problem wasn't his company. It was local and state governments.
Rates are high because people want commissions. And the people who set the rules, the counties and the states who want that income, directly create the high rates. When there are no site commissions, the evidence is clear. Rates become extremely affordable.
Again, that's Brian Oliver, the CEO of Global Telink, speaking to NPR last October. Representative Ammons, maybe we can talk a little bit about these the revenue and the fees and all of these things. I know you've said in the past, Illinois receives more revenue than any other state in the country, $12 million a year for prison phone calls. That's how much the state is getting in revenue. Can you explain what Brian Oliver was talking about with site commissions and how that works in Illinois and all of these different fees?
Yeah, I like the way they call it site commissions. I call it kickbacks. In reality, what we saw happening is Illinois has the highest rate of commissions in the country. So for every dollar, 76 cents of that dollar actually goes to the state of Illinois. So $12 million is actually a low number compared to the high of maybe about $14 million that we saw as we studied this issue. We also saw that this case of commissions or kickbacks indeed drives the cost up substantially. Now, the companies can, again, lower their rates, but if they're charging all of these other additional fees on top of the rate, plus paying the commission to the state of Illinois in this case, we see that the call can go. Even if it's 2 minutes, you still have to pay the same amount of money, whether it's 2 minutes or 30 minutes, doesn't make a difference. And so we wanted to address this from a consumer side view. The consumer should not pay the state of Illinois to provide a service that the state should provide for those who are incarcerated. That's the basic premise here. And the company like Global GTL and Securus and all of these other companies, they are still making their profit regardless of what happens. The state has to fund its services appropriately through the Department of Correction budget, but not pass that on again to the families of people who are incarcerated.
That's State Representative Carol Ammons. In studio with me as well is Wanjel Harvey Robinson. We were just talking about her story of when she, more than 10 years ago, when she was a child and how much she had to pay in these phone calls when she was speaking to her parents when they were incarcerated. And Wanjel, as you're listening to this, as you're listening to Representative Ammons talk about the different fees, whether they're the state fees, what the state is getting, whether what these companies are doing, who, in your mind, who's most responsible for this and how does this problem need to be solved?
I believe that the state is most responsible because each state has a fund, and if you know what you're doing, you won't have to worry about taking money from the poor to, I don't know, satisfy your own needs. So if a company's already getting their commissions or their profit, as Representative has already said, there's no reason for you to overly charge a 2-minute phone call that's not nearly equivalent to a 30-minute phone call.
And I mean, as you say that, I mean, as we're talking about who you think is responsible, I wanted to ask you, Representative Ammons, as we look at the revenue side of this situation, certainly, I don't think you can have this conversation without the context of the state budget and the budget climate.
Yeah.
How difficult was it for this bill to pass the House? What opposition did you face because of the revenue situation?
I think that was the only real strong concern from my colleagues in relationship to the state budget. The biggest issue that I wanted to point out to my colleagues is that, one, majority of the money wasn't actually going to the Department of Corrections in the first place. So although
there, where is it going?
It was going to Central Management Services, which is a state agency. It actually didn't get from Securus to our Department of Revenue. It went to CMS, and a small portion of it went to the Department of Corrections. So my colleagues could clearly understand that there was two issues here. One, the money actually wasn't going to the Department of Corrections until just last year. And two, that there's a fundamental problem here, that you're actually charging the highest commission possible on a contract in order for a service provider to have that contract. So there was still an ethical question that I raised with my colleagues, which I'm thankful for those who voted yes, who could see that as an ethical problem. And secondly, the state, as we look at the state budget, the state has to really get serious about the needs of the state, the revenue that's necessary to run our state departments. And they really have to say to the people in our state, you know, we're not going to pass any more of these unethical measures that we've been doing by doing pension swapping and holidays and all of these things that have put us in the situation that we're in. We're going to start a new leaf here. And I believed wholeheartedly that the governor's reform measures needed to include this issue.
Representative Ammons, do you think it's hard to have that conversation in the middle of such a crisis? Because what you're talking about, I feel like you're talking about something that's about 15 paces ahead of where we are at right now in terms of state government and politics. So it's actually interesting to me that you were able to get this past the House, because this is something you're talking about that's fixing more fundamental problems when we're still in the middle of a crisis.
I think the crisis is created, again, by a set of unfortunate political values that don't align with the values of the people in the state. The people of the state, as they hear about this issue, can completely understand why we would not want to charge, for instance, commissions on paper, pencils, and pens that go to our university system in order for someone to provide that service. It was a very easy concept for legislators. I, as a legislator, can't sell a contract to a potential vendor. I can't do that because of ethics laws. I would actually go to prison for the same practice that the state is doing on Department of Corrections in this case, because it doesn't exist anywhere else. And I think that becomes the value judgment. And I think our colleagues really understood that. And then finally, I think the basic issue here is that the Department of Corrections don't pay it. The inmates don't pay it. It's the poor families of those on the outside who have to pay the additional tax that no one else has to pay unless you have someone inside of Department of Corrections.
Does the Department of Corrections support this bill?
They do not.
And I wanted to ask you about that, because I know when other states' law enforcement say they need these fees to pay for the calls, for staff to monitor the calls for security reasons, they say without them, they'll have to reduce the number of calls allowed to those in prison. Have you heard any of those arguments here in Illinois?
I hadn't heard. What I heard was just a little bit opposite of that, that the money was being used for other inmate benefit services, which we couldn't specifically drill down to say, yeah, all the money went there. Remember, the money actually didn't go to the Department of Corrections. It was going to CMS. So the question remained for the Department of Corrections, well, how were you paying for these services prior? Because you weren't getting the money in the first place, right? So it didn't work in Illinois in the same way that it may have worked in other states, because we weren't getting all of the money to the Department of Correction. So the small percentage that was going to the Department of Corrections, it is the responsibility of the state to fund them appropriately.
Wenchel, when we're thinking back to your experience as a child, and obviously you were a kid then and your grandmother was running the household and paying the bills, but I wonder now that you're an advocate for this issue, I'm sure you've talked to your family about what the situation was like back then. And I wonder what things maybe you all didn't get to do because you wanted to have those phone calls with your parents because you weren't able to afford to do other things. Was that the case?
I know that I wanted to be involved with different extracurricular activities while I was younger. So it was like either do the extracurricular activity or talk to your mom or your dad. And that's like a hard choice because you want to be good. You want to build a good resume while you're in school, but you also want to have that connection so that when your parents come home, you can still embrace them with love that you know, not just off of remembering. So.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember as a kid, I wonder if you could take us back to when you had those calls, how they made you feel, what kind of things you would say to your parents?
I remember since we have an upstairs downstairs, my grandmother would have the phone and me and my younger brother would like sprint downstairs, run each other over just to get to the phone. And also, mind you, we had to share that phone call. It wasn't like we both got 10 minutes to talk. There was like seven
minutes. How many of you were you?
Three.
There were three of you.
Yes.
For a 7-minute phone call.
Three of us for a 7-minute phone call that you're just shaking the phone. Wait, what did you say? I couldn't hear you. And then sometimes it hung up and we're just like, well, are they going to call back? Probably not. We can't call them because, like, you know, the inmates can't receive phone calls.
Representative Ammons, just really quickly for you, what's next for the bill?
So the bill is in the Senate now. Senator Collins is the Senate sponsor of the bill. She has had a lot of work around this issue. And so they've made some effort in the past to try to deal with the commissions and the kickbacks. But this is the first opportunity since I've been there for them to take this issue up. So they hope to have it in committee this week. I would imagine Tuesday, Wednesday for a committee vote. And then it should be on the Senate floor, hopefully by the end of the week.
That's Representative Carol Ammons. She's a Democrat from Urbana. She's a sponsor of a bill that passed the House last week that would cap prison phone rates. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you also to Wanjell Harvey Robinson for sharing your story. Thanks for being with us, Wanjell.
Thanks for the invitation.
Coming up on the 21st, big changes ahead for how e-cigarettes will be regulated. The Illinois Department of Public Health is here to answer your questions. What do you have about e-cigarette use? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show. That's 21ST Show on Twitter. That's our handle. Again, our phone number, 1-800-222-9455. That's up next.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering discovery by providing information curation and archival services to extend scholarly impact from Urbana-Champaign to the state, the nation, and the world. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The FDA announced late last week that e-cigarettes, along with tobacco products such as cigars and hookahs, will be regulated in the same way as traditional cigarettes. That means all components of e-cigarette devices will have to go through a lengthy and sometimes expensive approval process. It also means you have to be 18 years old to purchase these products, and they'll include health warnings on the package just like regular cigarettes. The CDC says e-cigarette use has tripled among middle and high school students. That's between 2014 and 2015. Joining us today to talk about all of this, Dr. Nirav Shah is on the line with us from Springfield. He's the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Dr. Shah, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much, Nyla.
I want to extend this also to everybody who's listening. If you have questions, Dr. Shah is here to answer them. 1-800-222-9455. Again, 1-800-222-9455 is our phone number. You can tweet to 21st Show. Dr. Shah, can I ask you a really basic question? Are e-cigarettes the same thing as vaping?
For practical purposes, yes. There are, in any field like this, where any new field, there's a lot of different terms that are thrown around and for what can often be the exact same thing. But at base, vaping is the same as what this rule uses as the term e-cigarettes. And what that entails is a liquid that is placed into a device that is heated by coils, and that generates a vapor that is inhaled by the user and then blown back out.
So what are the health differences between your kind of old school cigarette and an e-cigarette?
Well, the research around e-cigarettes is intense and ongoing. And there isn't really a clear answer to the question that everyone wants to know, which is what you ask, what are the relative health differences between e-cigarettes and conventional cigarettes? Right now, what we know is that because e-cigarettes do not involve combustion, the smoke that is found with traditional cigarettes doesn't enter the body. Now, there's still the question of what is in e-cigarettes that could potentially be harmful. We know there's nicotine in them. There are also small microparticles and other nanoparticles and aerosols that are in e-cigarettes, and really their scientific consensus is still being formed about what the long-term health implications, if any, those particles may contain.
Dr. Shah is here to answer your questions about e-cigarette use. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet your questions as well to 21st Show. Dr. Shah, I mentioned at the beginning of this, e-cigarette use has tripled among middle and high school students. That's CDC data from 2014 to 2015. Is that what prompted the FDA rules?
That's certainly part of it. What we've seen in recent years is that although use of conventional cigarettes has declined, use of e-cigarettes has gone up. Another factor in the background that prompted the FDA's rules is concern around the liquids that are actually used in the e-cigarettes. Many of these liquids can be made in someone's home or in a regional center that might not undergo the same degree of certifications and training that might be needed to ensure their safety. These two factors, along with other concerns about just the general health implications of these e-cigarettes, is what together prompted FDA to move forward with rules.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that. I want to get to, in a minute, we're going to get to sort of the state laws about this, but I wanted to ask you about, there's a new study that's actually out today from the journal Pediatrics that shows a spike in the number of calls to poison centers because of children being exposed to nicotine and tobacco products. Is that what you're talking about in terms of the risks of young children's exposure to liquid nicotine?
That's right. Almost every week, there's a new study on both sides of this debate that on one hand suggests that there are more and more health effects that were previously unthought of with respect to e-cigarettes. The latest one today that you mentioned, Nyla, was out in the Journal of Pediatrics that showed that just in the course of this study, the number of calls to poison control centers with respect to children who may have been exposed to e-cigarettes in harmful doses went up considerably. At the same time, virtually every week, there's another study that comes out that suggests that e-cigarettes are also helpful to help individuals wean themselves off of smoking as a replacement for traditional nicotine cigarettes.
Yeah, where do you stand on that? Or maybe I should ask, where you stand on that? Where does the Illinois Department of Health stand on that?
Well, you know, our view of this is driven by the science, and the science evolves every day. The answer to this question is almost a deeply philosophical one. It comes down to whether you think that products that have some degree of harm, like e-cigarettes, should be regulated out of existence, whether we want to announce that they're bad, or alternately, whether we think that something that is comparatively less harmful than a conventional cigarette, e-cigarettes, should be something that's encouraged. That latter strategy is thought of or called harm reduction.
Okay.
And it's a difficult question, partly because the science is really evolving. Let me be clear. No one thinks that e-cigarettes are good for you or safe. That's no one's position. The question here is whether their use should be encouraged as a second-best solution for someone who's trying to quit regular conventional cigarettes.
Right, because maybe they're not as bad, basically.
Perhaps.
Maybe. Okay.
Perhaps.
When there's a no smoking, and so I wanted to shift our conversation a little bit. When we are happy to take folks' questions about the public health aspect of this, but I wanted to ask about how this gets implemented in terms of public policy. And when there's a no smoking policy in restaurants or malls, Dr. Shah, does that extend to e-cigarettes, or does that depend on the facility?
It depends very much on the location. So we'll start with a couple aspects of this rule. One part of the new FDA rule is to prohibit the sale of e-cigarettes to anyone under the age of 18. That has been the law in Illinois for quite some time. So that aspect of this new FDA rule doesn't really impact Illinois. In fact, it only impacts two states. Michigan and Pennsylvania are the only two states that don't have a minimum age of 18. Now, with respect to your second question about the limits of the Smoke-Free Illinois Act, that really does depend on the type of location. There has been legislation over the years to extend the definition of the Smoke-Free Illinois Act to encompass or to include e-cigarettes. Thus far, that has not yet happened.
That's Dr. Nirav Shah. He's the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. And in studio with me as well as our producer, Christine Herman. She covers health and science issues for the 21st. And Christine, I was hoping you could fill us in on what Dr. Shah was talking about in terms of at the state level, has there been a ban? As he's saying, has that ban on e-cigarettes in public place, has that ever been attempted here in Illinois?
Yeah, it has been attempted. So like in February of 2015, lawmakers were considering extending the ban on cigarettes to in public places to also include e-cigarettes. So that was House Bill 2404 introduced by Representative Kathleen Willis. She's in Springfield. So that was an attempt for to have Illinois take a more uniform stance on e-cigarette use, but that that bill doesn't appear to be getting any traction this year.
And so what does exist? It seems like different municipalities are kind of adopting different rules.
Right. So the Smoke-Free Illinois Act that Dr. Shah mentioned, that was introduced, you know, back in 2008, that banned smoking cigarettes and tobacco products in all public places and workplaces, so offices, theaters, restaurants, and bars. And now some local municipalities are starting to extend that ban to include traditional cigarette that ban that's on traditional cigarettes to also include e-cigarettes.
Right. So where's the most recent? I think did something most recently happen in Decatur?
Yeah. So the Decatur Park District just announced last month that they're going to begin banning e-cigarette use in all of their indoor facilities. So the executive director there, Bill Clevenger, he told the Herald and Review that park district leaders, they may strengthen the smoking rules eventually to also include other areas where kids are playing sports.
And I know Chicago, this has been a really big issue in Chicago. Mayor Emanuel has been talking about this since 2013. Chicago, I think, has the most strict rules. What are they?
Yeah. So back in January 2014, the Chicago City Council passed e-cigarette regulations banning them from indoor public places and also within 15 feet of building entrances. So this includes private establishments that are places of what so-called public accommodation. So that includes restaurants and bars. And the final version of this law banned all e-cigarettes, regardless of whether they even contain nicotine.
Dr. Shah, does IDPH have an official position on what the law should be in Illinois for e-cigarettes? Do you think that the ban, that there should be a ban, that it should be included, especially now in light of what the FDA has started to do?
We don't have an official position. We did support some of the measures that Christine mentioned, but we don't have an official position on whether e-cigarettes should necessarily be restricted or regulated in the same way that conventional cigarettes do. That's partly because, as I mentioned earlier, the science is still evolving on this. And this very challenging policy question of whether e-cigarettes are categorically bad or whether they're a second best solution is one that really where the jury is still out, and where you stand on that one depends on where you sit. And when the science becomes more clear, that's when we think the agency will take a more formal position.
Dr. Shah, would you say that the FDA's rules then, are they behind what other states are doing, or do you think they lay a groundwork for other states to go further in terms of banning e-cigarette use or sales?
It's a little bit of both. With respect to some of the restrictions of tobacco products like e-cigarettes, when it comes to ages, locations of sale, those are actually in many respects consistent with what other states have already done. I mentioned the restriction on sales to individuals younger than 18, something that 48 states have already done. Another part of the rules are things that really only FDA can do. Being a national agency, it is really only FDA that has the ability, the scientific wherewithal, and really in some cases the power to require that e-cigarette manufacturers and liquid manufacturers submit all of their products for testing. And so in that regard, they were stepping into a space that really virtually no state would have the ability to regulate.
Dr. Shah, can we talk about the marketing of this, and especially when we're thinking about younger children? What rules exist right now in terms of, and I know Senator Durbin from Illinois issued a statement last week saying that he wished the FDA had gone further in terms of how regulating marketing was happening with these, in terms of particularly for younger children.
The regulation of marketing of cigarette devices, e-cigarette devices to minors has been a very hotly contentious issue for years. This is something that is of great concern in the public health community. There is a lot of data that you mentioned at the beginning, Nyla, that suggests that e-cigarette use, particularly among individuals, younger individuals, has gone up considerably in recent years. Now, the question is whether those individuals would have otherwise gone on to smoke conventional cigarettes, or whether by smoking e-cigarettes they've substituted for the more harmful traditional cigarettes. Regardless of what your view on that is, the regulation of the advertising of these products to minors is something that generates quite a lot of interest and still quite a lot of debate to this day.
Dr. Shaw, that's a really great point you just brought up. I just wanted to mention and ask you a question. So there's a study from the CDC from earlier this year that showed that over the past several years, advertising for e-cigarettes has increased. And along with that, the rise in e-cigarette use among minors has also gone up. So now it's like roughly 13% of high school students are using e-cigarettes now. And so what advice do you give to parents about this?
You know, our advice here with respect to parents and how they interact with their children is to have frank and open conversations with them. As I mentioned earlier, there's no one that thinks that e-cigarettes are safe. And so parents need to know that these products do pose a risk to their children. Is the risk as great as that from cigarettes? Probably not, but the science is still out. And so we recommend, and I would recommend that parents approach a conversation with things like e-cigarettes in the same way that they might with any other potentially addictive substance, that their children should be given information about the risks and if the benefits, if any, and should be really told that these products can carry a risk to them. And we know that that teens are very swayed by their peer group, of course. That's almost the nature of being a teenager. But to the extent possible, parents really ought to have frank conversations with their kids to let them know that what might be the right thing or the socially acceptable thing to do today might have long-term health consequences.
And you had mentioned earlier about young children getting exposed to nicotine, and we were talking about the new study from the Journal of Pediatrics. Well, will the new FDA guidelines include any action to make it harder for children to get harmed by e-cigarettes?
Well, other than the restriction on sales, which again was something that existed in virtually every state, these new rules are really much more about regulating the actual existence of these tobacco products on the market rather than the choice or the direction of sale or the marketing efforts. That goes back in part to some court decisions that came out when the statute was first passed. And so really this statute right now, or these new rules rather, are really going to focus on regulation and approval of e-cigarette devices and the vaping liquids themselves.
And when you talk about those devices, I did want to ask about the child nicotine poisoning prevention law. I know that's supposed to take effect this summer, and that's going to require child-resistant packaging of liquid nicotine containers. Do you feel like this is really just also kind of just from a public health standpoint, something parents need to know if they have young children around to be careful, as we were mentioning earlier about the calls that are, we're seeing such an increase in calls to poison control centers about kids. I know some of them, most of them under age two or younger, who are finding these devices.
That's absolutely right. These devices could potentially pose risks to children in one of two ways. The first is from the vapor that is emitted. There are a lot of folks that say that what comes out of these devices is just water vapor, but we know now that that's not true. In addition to water vapor, there are other particles that are contained in this vaping cloud that could potentially be harmful to children. It hasn't been directly studied, but we have enough science to suggest, or at least to merit caution. Another way that these products could be harmful is from the combustion in the product itself. There are a number of reports of these products, even when used properly, potentially causing fires and exploding. And so parents should absolutely be aware that there are risks to using these devices in the presence of small children.
And then apart from that, and there's sort of the question of kids finding it, but just to be clear, are you saying that you feel like we've often heard about secondhand smoking for years, but it seems like you're issuing a note of caution about, I don't know if you want to say secondhand vaping or whatever you want to call it, around children?
Whatever term we want to call it, I think there is cause, the science suggests rather, that there is cause to be a little bit skeptical of the notion that what is emitted from these devices is purely water vapor.
Okay.
There is enough data to suggest that there is more than just water vapor that is emitted from these devices. These small aerosolized particles do exist in the vape that comes out of this. Now, what the precise health implications of those small particles and those fumes are is very much under constant study right now. But I think it's sufficient to at least, as you said, exercise some caution when using these products around small children.
That's Dr. Nirav Shah, director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Thanks to him and Christine Herman. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Illinois Republicans are distancing themselves from apparent presidential nominee Donald Trump. Rahm Emanuel's approval ratings plummet to 25%. And Speaker Madigan's business ties to Governor Rauner. It's our regular Monday politics segment. Today, our guests are Ivan Moreno, joining us from Springfield, where he's the AP State House correspondent. Ivan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And on the line today, she's in New York. Carol Felsenthal is a magazine writer and blogger for Chicago Magazine Politico and The Hill. Carol, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks.
Carol, let's start with Donald Trump. I just feel like I have to ask, you've covered I don't know how many election cycles. Were you surprised at how well Donald Trump did in Illinois?
Well, once he got his momentum going, I figured that he'd win Illinois. You know, it was nothing like the race between Clinton and Sanders, which really ended up being much closer in Clinton's favor, but much closer than anybody predicted. But I figured, you know, I figured he'd win here because he's got some kind of loony sort of appeal to people, and he's winning all over. I mean, look what he did in New York. True that he lives here, but he certainly there aren't a lot of people who identify with him. So
Carol, how do you think?
Surprising. I think, you know, the fact that what happened last Tuesday when Cruz dropped out and then Kasich followed, that was a little surprising to me. So now we have this election featuring Donald Trump, and I, just like I said before, he'll never be the nominee. Now I'll maybe be wrong again, but I can't imagine how he's going to win this election.
But that loony sort of appeal, perhaps, as you've said, does not maybe extend to Illinois Republicans, because we've seen across the board, particularly, and let's start with Senator Kirk, is not even going to be attending the convention. And how much of that has to do with his race against Tammy Duckworth?
Oh, I'd say 100%. He would be worried about a photographer catching him in the same frame as Donald Trump. But he's stuck in a very bad position. And, you know, some of the things that Trump has said during this campaign have been very surprising and makes me wonder just how much of at least a speech deficit remains from the massive stroke that he suffered in 2012 that kept him out of the Senate for a year. But, you know, he said that he certainly will support Trump, and Duckworth's people have been going to town with that. And my prediction here is that Duckworth will easily take the seat from Kirk, who won by a narrow margin against an ethically challenged opponent in 2010 when he was in great health. And the thing about Kirk is he was one of the most verbally fluid members of the U.S. Senate. I mean, really great on national security and on Israel, which is a big subject that kept him in his House seat for five terms. But I think this time, Illinois is a very blue state. Barack Obama is popular here. Hillary Clinton has roots here. She grew up here, and I think it's going to be an easy win for Tammy Duckworth. And one other thing, which is really bizarre, is when asked why he was skipping the convention.
What did he say?
He said, made this odd kind of icky statement that he was going to spend the week making sure that his hair is perfect. And maybe he was making an allusion and a joke to Donald Trump's weirdly constructed, weave-ridden, sprayed hairstyle, but it just came off as just just odd.
How confusing.
When you think of Senator Cook, he just has regular man hair like nobody would think about his hairdo.
Yeah. Now, well, this is the first time, I will admit to you, Carol, I've ever thought about Senator Kirk's hair.
Right.
Ivan Moreno, what about Governor Rauner? He also said last week that he wasn't going to be attending the convention.
That's right. And his announcement came about a few weeks after he had also said that he was going to support Trump if he was the nominee. And then he said that he wouldn't be going to Cleveland after all. I think that the issue here is, even though his office is saying, you know, he has better stuff to do here in Springfield, Illinois, with the budget crisis, the reality is he also is looking at how him supporting Trump would affect not only him, but also other lawmakers in down-ticket races. Republicans are in the minority in the legislature, and the Democrats have supermajorities in both chambers, so it's not like the legislature is up for grabs. But the issue here is Rauner really wants to prevent Democrats from making more gains in the legislature, which would allow them to have even bigger supermajorities with a comfortable enough cushion that they could pass whatever budget they want without implementing his reforms. So Rauner, I think, is looking at sort of a long game here and trying to distance himself with Trump. And you're seeing that with other Republicans in the state as well. Republican U.S. Congressman Kinzinger also said last week that he wasn't going to support Trump, and in fact said that some of his foreign policy ideas frighten him. So you are seeing a lot of Republicans, particularly ones in tight races or ones who have a lot to lose come November, you know, whether it's themselves or their colleagues, sort of distance themselves from someone who they really see as a firebrand for the majority of mainstream Republicans.
That's Ivan Moreno in Springfield. Ivan, I do want to get back to budget negotiations, so I'm going to ask you about that in a minute. But Carol, I wanted to ask you first about the big story in Chicago this weekend. The New York Times poll conducted with the Kaiser Family Foundation, really shockingly low approval levels for Mayor Emanuel. Can you fill us in on the rest of the story?
Yeah, so you know, one thing before we leave the Rauner and Trump thing is that Trump said, and I was stunned by this, that he didn't know who Bruce Rauner, he doesn't know who Bruce Rauner is.
Oh, he said that? He said, I don't know who Bruce Rauner is? Donald Trump said that?
He said he didn't recognize a name. And it struck me, like punched me in the gut, that here you have a guy who's running for president of the United States. He's supposedly the titular leader of the Republican Party. Like,
he doesn't
know that?
The governor of Illinois' name.
Yeah, I mean, that you wouldn't know who Rauner was. It means he doesn't follow politics, because Illinois is like a super important state, so I was really shocked by that. The New York Times Kaiser Family Foundation poll was truly awful, terrible, bad news for Rahm Emanuel, because it comes after the Laquan McDonald shooting video, which many of us here, and I would include me in that camp, think that Rahm knew about but withheld, so that he would win re-election in that runoff against Chuy Garcia, and he won with the crucial help of the African-American vote. So he was sliding in popularity, all those protests, you know, in downtown in front of his house, calling on him to resign, and then things kind of eased up. And now you have the New York Times and the Washington Post on the tail of the New York Times writing about this in a big way. And who does Rahm Emanuel care more about than the New York Times and the Washington Post?
Let's ask about, sure.
National.
And apart from the national media and how Rahm Emanuel feels about the national media, I'm curious your thoughts, and Ivan, I'd love for you to jump in too after Carol, about the national media's depictions of Chicago and Illinois, and because you sort of see a dominant narrative in the headlines of Chicago and Chicago's problems. And now this poll, which says that just 8% of people in this poll, 8% of people said they thought that Mayor Emanuel cared a lot about people like that.
Right. And there, you know, it's interesting that this comes from the New York Times. If the New York Times did its poll on its own, then you could say this is just some kind of competitive silliness.
But it was done with the Kaiser Family Foundation.
Yeah, but they did it with, you know, with the partner, and the numbers sound about right. The disapproval of, I think it's 70% among African Americans.
80%, correct,
Rahm
yeah.
Emanuel, the takeaway that he is just not an effective and competent leader, and the sense that this is a divided city, that it's the north side is a wonderful place to be, the north side of the city. It's a great city to raise your kids. You can find decent public schools or send your kids to private schools or private Catholic schools. But the south and the west side, and they, of course, lump parts of the south and the west side are lovely places to live in, but they lump them together, and I think in a kind of ignorant way, to say these are the south side and the west side are like Detroit. I mean, the very, very blunderbuss kind of coverage, but in the end, it's really a problem for Rahm Emanuel at the same time as he's got this really, you know, unworkable plan to bring the George Lucas Museum here and borrow $1.2 million.
Well, and also negotiations with the Chicago Teachers Union, because that's
right.
The other situation yes. going on.
Big thing.
Ivan, I wanted to ask you about a Chicago Sun-Times story also this weekend that people may have missed late Friday night, I believe, about House Speaker Michael Madigan's financial and business dealings with Governor Rauner. What do we know about that?
Well, again, this is something that Chicago Sun-Times wrote about recently, and it talked about how, despite the fact that these two guys are locked in an epic standoff over the budget, they both have in investments that in same companies that they both sort of benefit from. Madigan has a law firm that represents a lot of businesses and helps them with their taxes and getting tax credits. And in one instance, one of those companies is a Chicago Board of Exchange with Rauner also having investments there. Again, both sides kind of shrug it off as saying, you know, we kind of distance ourselves from that, and we're not really involved in the day-to-day of what happens there, but it certainly...
It's just the business dealings of our companies.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Exactly. I know that we are in the final stretch for budget negotiations, but I wanted to ask what the most significant thing was you thought, first of all, that happened in Springfield last week. What do you think was the biggest thing people need to know about in terms of what actually was accomplished?
Well, the lawmakers kind of hit a bit of a roadblock when it came to moving along their education budget. This is the annual spending plan for public schools. Of course, because Governor Rauner signed the education budget last year, public schools were allowed to open, and they haven't really suffered a lot of the consequences of the state not having a budget. Now with the state almost reaching a full year without a budget, people are looking to see what will happen with schools if Democrats and the Republican governor will be able to agree on a budget and thus allow schools to open. Rauner wants to just pass a budget without really changing the formula of how each district gets their money. Democrats are pushing a plan that would really overhaul this 20-year-old formula. They say that it's unfair and inequitable and needs to change. And so they're kind of heading into this sort of standoff where Rauner says, let's just pass an education budget, and Democrats are saying we need to change the formula first. And this bill Democratic Senator Andy Menar is proposing that would overhaul the formula was scheduled for a vote a couple of times in the Senate last week, and it was delayed. He's still trying to gather support from it.
Actually, Senator Menar and Senator Biss are actually talking about that at the City Club in Chicago today, I think trying to get support for that, right?
Yeah.
Ivan, we just have a minute or two left, but budget negotiations. Are we in the final stretch? What's our timing on this?
Well, we are in the final stretch as far as how easy it would make or easier it would make to pass the budget. Now, if lawmakers can't agree on a budget by the end of May, what's going to happen is any bills that they pass are going to require supermajority. So it's going to make negotiations much tougher. Right now, they could pass a budget with just a simple majority. If they don't pass it by the end of May, they could still continue to work on it, probably via special session, but it's just going to make it a lot harder for them to pass something. I mean, you could even kind of make a bet that if they don't pass something in May, you sort of write off the year, and it might be until after the elections, because in an election year, you're going to, you know, passing something with a supermajority, particularly something that's probably going to require a tax increase, is just going to make it a lot harder for both sides to agree on.
Lots to happen in the next couple of weeks. Ivan Moreno is AP State House correspondent in Springfield. I know you're going to be busy. Carol Felsenthal, thanks for joining us from New York. She's based in Chicago, a magazine writer and blogger for Chicago Magazine, Politico, and The Hill. Thanks for being with me, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
That does it for our show today. Tomorrow, we're talking about American Dream Reimagined. We want to share stories of why our families came to this country. It's part of a project we've been doing called American Dream Reimagined. Tomorrow, our guests include the Multicultural Community Center in Rantoul and the director of the Champaign County Historical Archives. Do you want to share your family story? Call our hotline, 217-300-2121, to share why your family came here. We'll try to play it on the air tomorrow. Again, our hotline number, 217-300-2121. And tomorrow, for you Redditors out there, I'm doing an AMA. That's an Ask Me Anything, really. You can ask me anything tomorrow, but you can only do it on Reddit. Check out our Facebook page or our Twitter stream for details. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
On the next Fresh Air, Richard Russo. In his new novel, Everybody's Fool, he writes about his father's generation.
I love their optimism. Those men who came back, like my father was a D-Day guy, and they had the GI Bill, and it looked like America would be theirs.
Also, a review of the final episode of The Good Wife. Join us.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
You may already know this, but I think the natural world in this part of Illinois is amazing. The birds in our skies, the wildlife among us, the native plants and trees, the streams that grace our landscape.